Cheap clothes come with a cost, and according to our next guest, there's a cost to the environment, the workers who make the clothes, and our culture in general. I'm Jill Majeau, and this is The Larry Mueller Show. With us is Dana Thomas, the author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. She is the European Sustainability Editor for British Vogue, a regular contributor to the New York Times, and hosts The Green Dream, a weekly podcast on sustainability. Fashionopolis is now out in a young reader's edition. What questions do you have about clothing manufacturers? Do you research before you buy? Well, we'd like to hear from you, so join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And just as a note, our first episode was recorded, but we are now live, so you can call in. Again, the number 800-642-1234. Dana, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a joy.
You bet. And what an interesting book. And I know that the original book for adults came out in 2019. Why did you think it was time to create a young reader's version?
Well, quite honestly, because the young reader's edition's publishing arm of Penguin reached out to me and said, we think that kids should read this too, and that we should spread this message widely to the public because it's a very strong and potent message. And maybe if we tell them about all the wrongs that particularly fast fashion do before they go in the shops, they won't go in the shops. And it, you know, it reminds me of a book I read years ago called Fast Food Nation. And then there was a teenage version of it, a young reader's edition. And I wonder how many of those kids read those and never stepped into Burger King and McDonald's. And I kind of hope the same impact will be with my book, that they won't step into H&M and Zara, that they'll think before they shop.
That's a really good point to make, because our kids really can make a difference, as we've seen in a number of different ways. So,
well, they'll be adults soon enough. It's easier to set the habit correctly from the get-go than try to break it later on.
It certainly is, because, you know, I mean, it's cheap and we want it, and it's so difficult to not buy it. But when we know about what the background is, it does make it easier. What kind of changes did you need to make to your original book to make it ready for young readers?
Actually, not a lot. I cut it in half.
Okay.
And I just started telling it like I would be reading to an 11-year-old. You know, I just sort of I've been always reading books to my daughter. Now she's 21, so I don't anymore. But I read books to her for a long time, all the way till she was 11 or 12 even. And we would just lie on the beach and I'd read books to her. So I had the voice in my head and I just wrote it in that voice.
Well,
it came very easily. Apparently, I did a good enough job at it that, you know, I thought, gosh, I've been struggling so hard to write beautifully for adults, but I'm a natural for sixth graders.
Sixth graders, yeah. Well, and you know what? I, as an adult, most of the time I'm an adult, I read it, and it, you didn't talk down to kids. You explained some things that I actually didn't know. An adult can read it too, and it's a little quicker than your original book. So
Right. There's
that.
Well, it's also my practice. I started my career in newspapering at the Washington Post, and we always would be remembering all the time that we were a family newspaper. And that, you know, we did aim to have, you know, kids reading the paper too, or at least teenagers. And so you didn't want to make it. You had to write for a broad public of all ages and all education levels. And so, therefore, I think I mastered that pretty early on. At least it seems so.
It seems so to me, too. Because, you know, we're kind of in the same way here. You know, we want to appeal to as many people as we can. How did the pandemic affect the clothing industry?
Well, it affected it in two ways. First, it affected businesses in that, of course, we all stopped shopping cold. I'm meaning going into stores, but
right.
Then there was an uptick in online shopping, and the uptick in online shopping really did benefit the fashion industry because it had kind of been behind versus things like books or all the other things that we order online. We still like going into stores and trying on clothes. And so it really did increase online shopping for fashion. But then the fashion industry did some really crummy things, like they started canceling the orders because they had no stores to put them in because they closed all their stores, right? And they did not pay for those orders. And the clothes were already made and they were sitting on warehouses and sitting on docks and containers just rotting in the sun. And it left these companies, these contractors, as they're known, high and dry. Most fashion companies today actually do not make clothes. They just design clothes and they do marketing and advertising. But the clothes are made by other people. And that's what I explain in the book. They're made by other independent factories. And the factory owners did not pay their workers because the factory owners were not paid by the fashion companies. And in places like Bangladesh, the workers were just dismissed and sent home without a check and said, too bad for you. And already they only earn about, you know, $90 or $100 a month for working and don't get paid overtime or anything like that. They don't have benefits. They don't have anything like that. And they were just like cut loose and sent home and said, too bad for you. And that impact by major, major corporations like PVH, which owns Tommy Hilfiger and Calvin Klein and some others, was really, really hurtful to people who were already poor to begin with. And some of them said that they were going to, you know, go home starving. They were suffering from starvation because they had no money to even buy groceries. And meanwhile, you know, the fat cats who own these companies were still, you know, living their best lives in Manhattan. And, you know, they were living in their apartments, but they weren't broke. They were far from broke. And so that was really crummy. And there have been some campaigns that rose up. One in particular has the hashtag pay up. You'll see on Twitter. You can also Google it and you'll see where the campaign is. And you can support it. And you can see which companies still have not paid back what they owed when they canceled. Some were shamed into paying and they did. But about half of them still haven't paid, which is really terrible. So that was the negative impact. Was it just sort of showed the bad business practices of some of these companies and make you want to find out about them and you want to question whether you should patronize them or not, because basically they treat fellow human beings like
they shouldn't
trash.
Be. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, I was very surprised to learn that the fashion industry produces 100 billion items annually and 20 billion of them are destroyed. I that just does not sound like a good business model to me either.
No, it isn't. There's a lot of waste. And it's not even that they're destroyed, as we learned last fall. Al Jazeera reported that they're in the Atacama Desert, the most southern desert in the world, in Chile, way down near Antarctica. They found dunes and dunes of unsold fast fashion just baking in the sun in the desert. That something like 35 or 40,000 tons of unsold fast fashion is shipped to South America and winds up just being piled up in this once pristine desert. Most of these clothes, because most of our fashion today is made of polyester or nylon, and these are petroleum-based fabrics. Basically, polyester is plastic, and so it never biodegrades. So these clothes are just going to bake in the sun for eternity in this once pristine desert. And when you see the pictures, your mouth drops. You go, I can't believe that. And, you know, they say that, you know, these are called the economies of scale, that we only need 8, but it's cheaper to produce 10, then let's produce 10 and throw away 2 and we'll make more money. But in fact, in the long run, I don't know. I was terrible at algebra, but that feels like really fuzzy math to me.
Yeah, I would think so too. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And it's certainly
waste is costly, even
it's
if it's not costly on your spreadsheet in that particular column. In the bigger picture, it's a waste of people's time, money, energy, resources, the soil, the water, the electricity, everything, the extra pollution that's emitted, all of that 20% that is just unnecessarily wasted.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's just talk about that a little bit. Now, we've heard of fast food, but not everybody's heard of fast fashion. So why don't you explain what that actually entails and what it is?
It's fast fashion is exactly as it sounds. It's fashion that's designed quickly, made really super quickly, put in stores really quickly, sold really quickly at super cheap prices. Everything is made in offshore cheap labor countries. It's made of the super cheap fabrics. The designers will go to the fashion shows, or even they don't even have to. They just look on Instagram pictures of the fashion shows. They see what they like, and they knock it off immediately. They reproduce it in a cheaper version, super fast, kind of tweak it a little bit. They'll take, you know, some sort of Gucci design or a Tom Ford design or a Marc Jacobs design or a Ralph Lauren design, and they'll do a really quickie version of it and get it into stores in 2 or 3 weeks, when, you know, Tom's or Marc's or Ralph's won't hit the stores for another 6 months. So basically their fashion's out of fashion before it gets to the store. And these cheap versions, they replenish them. You know, they change the items on the floor every day. So you go as often as you can. You keep going in to see if there's something new. And they've conditioned us to just like keep shopping and keep going looking for new. And so we buy 5 times more clothes than we did a generation ago, and we burn through them. The average garment today is worn 7 times before it's thrown away. You know, I have a rule of thumb. If it costs more to dry clean the item than it does to replace it, because then you didn't pay enough for it, okay? And a lot of people say, well, I can't afford to buy more expensive clothes. And I'm talking about brands like, these are brands like Gap, like H&M, like Zara, Mango, Forever 21, these, you know, these sort of quick, young, fast, they're fast. They just move fast, and we wear them fast, we get rid of them fast. And in fact, you can afford to buy more clothes, pay more for clothes. We've just been conditioned by these brands to think that we can't, because we're supposed to buy sackfuls of clothes. And we go around with carts, like shopping carts in the stores, and load them up with clothes and just buying en masse.
Yeah, I'm kind of guilty. I understand. It's so tempting, and they make them seem so wonderful, and we just need something new. And
it's like an addiction.
Yeah, who doesn't have an article of clothing in their closet that still has the price tags on? So yeah, we definitely.
And a lot of those get thrown away or given to donated.
Donated.
Still have the price tag. Yeah. Still have the price tags on.
Mm-hmm, yeah, for sure. You mentioned the North American Free Trade Agreement a lot in your book. Explain what the ingredient or the agreement was and what the effect of it was on the clothing industry.
Well, the North American Free Trade Free Trade Agreement, known as NAFTA, which we've all heard of at one point or another.
And we can use that now because it's much easier to say. So it's NAFTA.
NAFTA, which we hear about especially around the time of presidential elections.
Yes.
Was this trade agreement. We have trade agreements all over the place. There's also CAFTA, which is the Caribbean Free Trade Agreement. And there's, you know, there was another one that was going to be with Southeast and Pacific. And, you know, we have lots of free trade or trade agreements of many different kinds. But NAFTA was one that opened the borders between Mexico and Canada and the United States among these three countries, and that there would be free trade among these three countries without the heavy tariffs and that we had before, because we would pay tariffs, which were taxes, basically, when things were brought in from Mexico or when things from the United States went into Mexico. And they wanted to abolish that to open this free trade zone, basically, that this block of land of North America could move, you know, trade freely without the burden of taxes. So Ross Perot, good old Ross Perot, who was running for president in 1992 for the 1992 election, said that he believed that because of this, jobs were going to move to Mexico with a sucking, whooshing noise. And he predicted millions and millions of jobs and we would lose millions and millions of money in this deal because labor was so much cheaper in Mexico. So let's take a company like Levi's. I don't know if this is true with Levi's, but just to understand that they were making everything in America and they still own their factories at the time, and including in the Carolinas. And then they said, oh, but we can keep sewing. We can sew these jeans in Mexico, and if we're paying $20 an hour for the clothes to be made in North Carolina, we can pay $2 an hour in Mexico. And that means we make $18 per an hour on, you know, that this is pure profit. And that's when we started seeing profits of these companies going gigantically high. They were booming in the 90s. And we started seeing the really crazy overpaid CEOs because they were making so much money for the companies. And the jobs did go sucking out of America. And that's when we had the economic collapse of the South.
Mm-hmm. And excuse me, we do have to break real short here for news, but then we'll be back. We're talking with Dana Thomas. She is the author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. Our technical director today is Aubrey Ralph, and our on-air producer is Clara Neipert. And if you have a question about fast food or fast fashion, 800-642-1234. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Najoe, and we're talking about the cost of fast fashion with our guest, Dana Thomas. She is the author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. She is the European Sustainability Editor for British Vogue, a regular contributor to the New York Times, and hosts The Green Dream, a weekly podcast on sustainability. Fashionopolis is now out in a young reader's edition, and the subtitle on that one is The Secrets Behind the Clothes We Wear. So it's basically the same, similar book, similar title, but not quite the same. What would you like to know about the way fabric is produced? Do you have questions about how clothing is disposed of? Well, we'd like you to be part of the conversation, so join in by calling 800-642-1234 or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. So, Dana, right before the news break, we were talking about NAFTA and the effect that it had on the clothing industry. Was there anything more you wanted to add to that?
Well, the short version of this is that NAFTA really did kick off globalization. And while globalization had many great benefits, it had a lot of destructive tendencies as well. Jobs moved offshore, which is why we had such high unemployment in places like the Carolinas and where we used to have factories. All the factories, particularly the garment factories, closed. And even in New York City, there are very few left. And those jobs moved to low income and low cost countries such as Bangladesh, China, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Myanmar, where there's also political unrest and people just aren't treated very well. And, you know, we talk about how we can't afford to pay more for clothes, but in fact, one of the things that globalization did for us was it made clothes cheaper than they ever have been in the history of mankind. We actually now pay about the same amount of for clothes that our grandparents did or our great-grandparents did during the Depression, not adjusted for inflation or anything, the same price. And we used to buy clothes when I was one generation ago, when I was a teenager, were one-fifth or five times more than they are today. And today we buy five times more clothes. So it just shows that we can actually afford to pay more for clothes. That, you know, the pie charts that we have where it divides up what how much you spend in your household for this and that, that's like electricity, heating, food, blah, 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 and the clothes. We used to spend, you know, 20% of our income on clothes, and now it's in the very low single digits. But we buy five times more clothes. And what we're doing is contributing actually to our own lower income, because we're basically saying it's okay to pay those people so little to make our clothes. And if businesses think that it's okay for that, then they'll pay everybody that they employ less than they're worth. So we need to make sure that everybody everywhere in the world is paid what they're worth and that they're treated with, you know, treated humanely, that they get basic benefits like vacation, that you don't get fired because you're pregnant, you know. And this is what's happened with globalization. This is what happened because of NAFTA.
And what are these manufacturing factories, basically, I guess? What do they look like for the workers? What are the conditions?
Well, I went to Bangladesh for the book, And I visited two different kinds or three different kinds of factories. I also went to Vietnam for the book. And in Bangladesh, I visited a full-on sweatshop. I wasn't off the plane half an hour, and I was already in one. There was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them just lining the streets. And, you know, the place was just, I mean, to say filthy would be kind. I mean, there was slop on the walls. The floors were wooden and unfinished. Everybody was barefoot. And I think that's because they're afraid that they're going to put things in their shoes to steal from the company. So they work barefoot. There were children working in the factory. They were standing on pieces of cardboard so they wouldn't get splinters on their feet. The temperature was like 100 degrees Fahrenheit with 100% humidity. There were some fans blowing dust around the room, but that's about it. All the windows had bars on them. So if there was a fire, you couldn't get out. There was only one staircase going up and down, and it was encumbered with gigantic cartons. There was supposed to be some fire extinguishers, but they were broken. The place was just, like, I can't tell you. The furniture would look like it was all found in the street. None of it matched each other. It was just horrific. And it was making jeans for a pretty well-known company. So then I went to a nice factory that had been, that is following what's called the Accord for safety. At fire and safety, and it's much better. It's clean. There's somebody constantly sweeping to make sure that there's no thread or dust or detritus on the floors, that there's, you know, people with yellow vests on, so if there is an emergency, you go to them. They have whole walls filled with, you know, fire extinguishers and axes. The exits aren't locked. But still, those people were being paid $68 a month when I went to visit. At the time, the owner of Zara was worth $68 billion. So that just shows you how, you know, since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, that a handful of people get really, really, really wealthy by treating the masses really, really poorly.
Let's go to the phones. We have Jeff in Grand Marsh who has a question for you. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I was curious, when I buy my sweatshirts, a couple polo shirts, it seems like after four or five washings, they're starting to pill. Assuming that means it's a cheaper grade of cotton. But how do you know what you're getting?
Well, it's not cotton. It hasn't been cotton for a real long time. It's mostly polyester. And you just read the label and it'll tell you 60% polyester and 40% cotton. What it doesn't tell you is it will not tell you if it's organic cotton, because it won't be organic cotton. And organic cotton, of course, would be a far superior product. But only 1% of our cotton today is organic. So chances are it's not. And if it is, it will tell you it is organic. It will be made of conventional cotton, which is highly toxic. It's all about chemicals and water usage. Cotton, naturally, as I write in the book, is not a thirsty plant, but the hybrid version, the man-made version that we have today that's come from genetic engineering and manhandling and science is incredibly thirsty, because it produces six times more cotton per plant than an organic cotton plant would. And, you know, organic cotton seemed to be plenty fine for 3,000 years. But in the last 30 years, we needed to make sure there was six times more cotton balls on every plant. And again, that's just driven out of greed of the company owners. Greed, greed, greed.
And when you say thirsty, you mean that it needs more water.
Water,
to grow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you think about it, where we've always grown cotton, Texas, California, you know, the dry parts of California, like Bakersfield, India. These were deserts, right? Arizona. We grow it in the desert where it doesn't get a lot of water and the soil's really poor. It's a very basic, you know, it came from Central and South America. It actually is one of those crops that farmers used to think of as a last resort crop when nothing else would grow in that field. You could get one more season out of it by planting cotton and it would grow and it would do fine. And it goes into blossom traditionally, naturally, because when it is stressed by not being watered and by being really hot. And the new man-made genetic engineered one likes a lot of water. They use defoliants on it, you know, so that it's easier to pick, and they pick up a machine, because it produces six times more cotton per plant, it sucks out six times more nutrients from the soil, so it just ravages the soil. So, you know, it's science isn't always a great thing.
Depends on how you use it, right?
Exactly.
And to Jeff's point, how can we pick out something, number one, that's going to be of good quality, or number two, that we know hasn't been made by someone in these conditions?
In these conditions, well, that's the trick. You don't know, because our labels say made in somewhere. It doesn't tell you how it was made. But that is changing with things like the digital ID. I'm actually speaking to you from a place called Dumfries House in Ayrshire, Scotland, which is run by Prince Charles. And it's a sustainability center in Scotland. And they have a textiles department and division here where they're working with young students to teach them how to work in an artisanal way, the craft of it. But it's also a working regenerative farm. And one of the things that they've developed in the Prince's Foundation, Prince Charles's Foundation, they were talking about today, is the digital ID, which is an ID that's going to be embedded into clothes, and you can scan it with your phone, and it will tell you everything you want to know about that piece of clothing, where it was made, what it's made of. You know, it will trace it all the way back to the factory. Now, of course, a company can lie about that information, but one would hope they won't. And you can also just go to places like On Net-a-Porter or, you know, some of these other fashion websites, and they will have a sustainable section that you can shop from that will tell you that it's made of organic cotton, that it's made with non-toxic dyes, that it is made in a factory that has passed all sorts of certifications and doesn't have child labor. If you want to know, you can find out. But, of course, brands try to hide that information because most of the time it's not as good as it should be.
Sure. Well, thanks for that call. We also have Dennis in Dubuque, Iowa, who has a question for you, or actually comment. Hi, Dennis.
Hello.
Hello.
Good afternoon. Hey, you know, I heard you talk about they dumped all that clothes down there in South America, and I always see kids in Africa, they're wearing, and they send shiploads of things that people here in the United States can't use.
Yeah.
And I'm a 70-year-old man, and, you know, I have to buy two pairs of shoes because I got a small foot size, and I'm transitioning right now from the country to the city.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going through my stuff, and I'm just going to, what I don't need, and I don't know what the label is on it, but I might look. And I don't know, just a comment.
Okay.
Right.
Thanks, Dennis. And Dennis also said that it's important to do like thrifting and going to resale shops, right?
Resale shops, giving to charities. We have a bit more, because these companies overproduce, we have more clothes than we need. And during the pandemic, particularly when everyone was sort of Marie Kondoing their closets because they were sitting at home going, we don't need any of this stuff anymore, and throwing it away or passing it on to charity shops, there has been a surplus. The problem with shipping to Africa, you would think this would be a nice thing, is that Africa actually had its own, you know, tailoring and fashion community. They made beautiful clothes. They wove their own fabrics. They dyed their own, printed their fabrics. They had tailors and seamstresses. They made beautiful clothes. They had their own businesses. And now they're just wearing old Dallas Cowboy t-shirts, you know, they don't even know what that is, and carrying Coach handbags. And that basically by us sending all these clothes over to Africa, thinking we're doing good for them, we've killed their local business, their local fashion industries.
Now, it's not all bad news. You do highlight a number of new designers and manufacturers that are they're not growing or producing in that established way. So why don't you tell us about a couple of them?
Well, yes. My agent, while I was working on the book, would repeatedly call or send a note going, remember, this is the book of hope. The book of hope. Don't be completely Debbie Downer on us, okay? So I said, right, okay, only the first third of the book will set up the why we need to have hope, what the problem is, why this, and these problems are rooted from day one of the Industrial Revolution, because the Industrial Revolution began by weaving cotton for clothing and for, you know, textiles and for home textiles like curtains in Manchester, England. And it was actually also the beginning of globalization, because they shipped the cotton from America or from India to Manchester to have these factories that were built there staffed with women and children to make these clothes. And here we are doing exactly the same thing 250 years later. But some of the great folks that I met were like Sarah Bellows, who is outside of Nashville, and she has a company. She's the first person in America in 100 years to be making, to grow and produce natural indigo on a commercial scale. And she did this on her own. She started with her own little farm, and then it grew to a little bigger thing, and then bigger and bigger. Today, only 1% of all indigo for our blue jeans is natural, or maybe it's up to 2% now, but when I met her, it was 1% around the world. And it used, you know, 100 years ago, it was all, you know, or 120 years ago. And then when we invented synthetic indigo, that wiped out the natural indigo business. Well, she decided, because synthetic indigo is more stable and you can produce it 12 months a year, but it's made with toxic chemicals like cyanide and formaldehyde. And we have this against our skin. Is this such a good idea? So she started the natural indigo business. Well, I can tell you when I first laid eyes on her wearing those blue jeans made with natural indigo, wow. She looked like she was wearing fabric that was dipped in sapphires. It was just radiant. It just was such a blush, gorgeous cornflower blue. And she has just worked out a deal with Levi's where they are bringing natural indigo to the commercial jeans industry worldwide. So this is enormous. And soon you can have natural indigo jeans from Levi's and other companies very easily. And when you go to natural Levi's, natural indigo jeans, you're never turning back to the back to the synthetic stuff. It's just too beautiful. So she's just great. And she's just like this Wonder Woman. And then another great person is Natalie Channon in Florence, Alabama, who has a company called Alabama Channon. And it's all organic cotton jersey clothes, all made locally by seamstresses. One person makes the garment from top, you know, from beginning to end, signs it, and she sells worldwide. But she's based in Florence, Alabama, because it's a lot cheaper to live there and run her business there than it is New York City. She's not paying crazy amounts of money on rent and commuting and all that. So she's able to pay her seamstresses really decent sums, like they should be paid. Now, the clothes cost a lot of money. But she says, of course, they cost a lot of money because I pay my people right. And she said, I am not getting rich. I'm very, you know, I live in a modest home. I drive a Prius and my kids go to public school. I am not some fat cat living, you know, in a villa in the south of France with super yachts. But I pay my people right. And that means you got to pay for clothes. And that's just what we're not doing today, because we have been conditioned to think it's normal to pay $20 for a dress, or $1.50, or $2 for a bathing suit, when it is absolutely positively not. If something costs $10 in clothing, that means the person who made it was paid 10 cents. That's not right.
Yeah. And really, how many shirts, t-shirts do we need, right? We all have too much.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
Now, science is being used a lot to change the industry, from what I read in your book. Talk about some of the new processes that are being used.
Well, of course, the biggest one is robots. And a lot of people say, oh, robots are taking away jobs. But in fact, we've seen that robots do take away jobs, but they take away jobs nobody really wants. They're really crummy jobs. Yeah. Let's be frank, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, who wants to spend their entire day hand sanding blue jeans to break them in, inhaling all that dust and synthetic indigo and cotton fibers in a 100 degree factory with fans blowing around? I mean, I've been to these factories. I've seen these really crummy jeans and being paid, you know, and doing 10 pair or 5 pairs a minute all day long. I mean, talk about losing your mind, right? And so one of the cool things I saw was laser distressing of jeans. And it was a system invented in Valencia, Spain. So I went to see it in Valencia, Spain. But then I went to see it in action in Vietnam. And I walked into the factory, and it was cool and quiet and clean, instead of like hot and loud and dirty, like the place where they do everything by hand. And the guys, they take the jeans, they put them in the machine, the laser. They program it. It almost looks like they're sort of programming it like a game, like a video game. And they stand in their little stall and went behind the screen. It's all clean. And the lasers go down the jeans. And then it's all suddenly distressed. In like 10 seconds, it's over. You see little poofs of blue. But there's such great vacuum systems that it's all sucked up, so there's no air. And, you know, so there's no dust in the air. Clean. And these guys have been given cleaner jobs, safer jobs, better paying jobs because they're tech jobs. They've learned a great skill as opposed to just taking a rasp and like rasping your jeans, like, you know, and it's, they've been given a skill that they can actually take and use in other places and even other industries. They now know how to run tech. So while we're eliminating really crummy jobs where people are paid terribly, they're treated badly, they're not being paid overtime, and they always have to work overtime. It's called forced overtime. And they're in, you know, dangerous and filthy environments, we're creating really great new jobs that are clean, safe, and better paid. So robots are, I think, really great. And you need somebody to repair the robots. You need somebody to manage the robots. You need, so we're not losing that many jobs. We're just changing the jobs into better jobs. And then some other really cool things are, like, you know, we're moving into 3D printing of fashion, which is really cool.
That surprised me.
Yeah. I know, right? Mm-hmm. And then, you know, maybe one of these days you'll be at home and you order something on Amazon. And I mean, this is feeling a bit sci-fi, but so did cell phones a long time ago,
sure.
Right? And you, instead of getting the product sent to your house, you just sent the link, and then you zip, zip, zip it, and you print it out on your printer, your 3D printer at home, and there it is. You have your new Balenciaga-like gown that you can wear out for dinner. I don't know if it's really going to happen, but that's the idea behind it eventually.
Well, it's cool. And even, you know, we've got a couple minutes left here, but recycling of these clothes in that go down to the, you know, get your cotton fiber back out. So that's pretty cool,
too. Yeah, regenerating and recycling. And and this is the most important part of where we are in fashion right now, and actually in everything. Is that we're not just recycling, what it's called circularity. You know, like single-use plastic, we're getting rid of that, and basically all of our plastic will be regenerated, recycled. But it's not that it's just being recycled, it's that we're keeping it in circulation. That is, nothing's, you know, ideally nothing goes into landfill, that we can keep regenerating it. So people, there have been all these really cool entrepreneurs who are starting up these companies, one's in Seattle called Evernew, where they take old cotton t-shirts, jeans, sheets, you know, anything's 100% cotton, break it down to its molecular level, extrude it and spin it, and turn it back into virgin cotton or new cotton that can be then mixed with and spun and turned into clothing again. Somebody else is doing the same with cotton poly blends, because most of our clothes are blended with polyester of some sort because it's such a cheap material and or fiber. And the hardest part was to be able to separate those two once they've been blended, to unblend them. And so those clothes generally went into landfill. And this company called Worn Again has figured out how to separate the two and then regenerate each one and send it back out into the world again.
That is amazing.
So
yeah, there's definitely
really
help on the horizon. Thank you so much for being with us, Dina. We really appreciate it. And can't wait to hear what your next book's going to be about.
more to come.
Great.
And do turn into the green dream. I hope you'll enjoy it.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you very much. So
we've
been talking with Dina Thomas. She's the author of Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. And as she said, she is the host of The Green Dream, a weekly podcast on sustainability. Join us tomorrow on Garden Talk. We're going to look at organic vegetable gardening. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mealer. Stay well.